friend of mine works with an interesting congregation. He recently said to me, where I am, things are always the same. There is never any change. There is no eldership, and there probably will never be an eldership, because that would be a change. Because this congregation refuses to change, he said, the men never meet, because we'd make a decision and that would be a change. As I heard him say these things, and he was deadly serious, I said, well, what about the church budget? Certainly you have money coming in and money going out, and there are changes. He said, no, we don't meet and talk about that. Money comes in, money goes out. There are never any changes. I am not familiar with all the inner workings of this particular congregation, but I do know this. God is a God of order. In fact, a helpful principle was given by Paul when he discussed spiritual gifts in 1 Corinthians 14:40, and that's the verse that says, let all things be done decently and in order. When we think about all things being done in this manner, that is, decently and in order, that suggests, that implies a certain degree of planning. In recent weeks, we have looked at some things concerning the Bible and money. As Christians, when we come together, we make a regular contribution on the first day of the week, if that's how we're paid. And with money coming in week after week, God's people need to figure out where it needs to go. If we're having a steady stream of income, where is it going to be directed? How should we spend our money? The expenditure should be what, if we're going to please God? Just a few weeks ago, the elders got together with the deacons and put together a church budget. There were only a few people present at that meeting, but what was done that night should be important to each one of us. How should a congregation spend its collected monies? That is a relevant question. That is a question that comes up in some sense week after week after week. And that is a question that we need to turn to the scriptures and see if we can answer. A good beginning place when we think about the monies that have been collected is found in Acts chapter 11, verse 30. In the first century, of course, there were people who had spiritual gifts. And Acts 11 tells us about one of these men. He was a prophet named Agabus. This man had divine insight. He knew that a famine was going to come. He knew that a disaster was going to hit the area of Jerusalem, Judea, very, very soon. And because of the knowledge that he had, because of the foreknowledge, brethren sprang into action. They collected monies, and then these monies were sent to the appropriate area. And at the end of Acts 11, this is said, which also they did, that is, they gathered the money, sending it unto the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Notice, if you will, that after the money was collected, the Bible says that it was elders who received the collected funds. Now, if elders were the people who received the collected funds, it seems to be implied that elders were then the people responsible for distributing those monies. So when we think about church money, Acts 11:30 points us to a conclusion which says that elders are going to be the ones who have charge of determining how church funds should be spent. Now, they may take input from others. As they put forward a budget, and this was done when we sat down and worked on the budget, they would say, well, here are some categories that we need to spend some funds in. We want you to take a look at these categories, see what you think. As you look at these, you think that we have enough or too much or just right. Are there some other categories perhaps that we need to examine? But ultimately, as you look at Acts 11:30, you find that elders oversee the assets in a local congregation. As we look at Acts 11, we find another point that's instructive. Money in Acts 11 was intended for disaster relief, and that's clear. Because this area was going to be affected by a famine, these people were not going to have what was necessary to sustain life. At least on a regular basis, there was going to be suffering, so money was contributed to this particular effort. Not long ago, you may or may not know this, but this congregation spent some money. We sent some money down to the state of Florida. We were alerted about some people who had suffered damage. They were in bad shape because of the hurricane. We knew where to spend money. We knew that it would be well spent, so we sent some funds. Were we justified in doing that? Yes, we were. Acts chapter 11 provides us with an example of Christians doing that very thing. There is a similar matter in another section of the Bible, turning towards the back of the Bible to the first chapter of James. James 1, verse 27, we have a passage that's similar to Acts 11, but also dissimilar in some ways. James, you may remember from the 27th verse, spoke of pure religion. He also uses the word undefiled in the 27th verse. Well, this is the kind of faith that we want. We want a faith. We want a Christian life which is pure. We want a religion that is undefiled. How do we get those two things? Well, certainly a number of things are involved, but James mentions one specific item again in the 27th verse at the end of that first chapter. Pure religion and undefiled before our God and Father is this: to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Well, that's a verse that may be familiar to you. Perhaps you've read it and studied it. But what does the word visit in verse 27 mean? Well, sometimes we can understand a Bible word by defining it, and there are some other cases where we can understand a Bible word by looking at another place where it occurs. And in this particular instance, if we go back to the previous book, Hebrews chapter 2, verse 6, we're able to see what the word in James 1:27 means. Hebrews 2:6 has this same word. Now, as you're turning back to Hebrews 2, let me share with you this little fact. Usually when we see the expression Son of Man, that applies to Christ. We see Son of Man quite often in the Gospels, and again, that refers to Jesus. But in Hebrews 2:6, when we read about the Son of Man, it's not a description of the Lord. Son of Man in Hebrews 2 describes humanity, people, us. And again, it has that same word it's used in James 1:27. All right, if you found Hebrews chapter 2, verse 6, but one has somewhere testified, saying, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Or the Son of Man, not Christ, but humanity, that thou visited him. God has visited, same word that we have in James 1:27, mankind. Well, how did God visit humanity? He visited our world, of course, through Jesus Christ and through what Christ did. Stated another way, God's visit did something. God's visit accomplished something. There was action involved in it. And that is the same sense of the word in James 1:27. So when James says you go and you visit these people, he did not have in mind dropping by for 5 minutes and saying, well, I can see that you are in a horrible state. Things are not good. Your conditions are deplorable. And I sure hope, brother or sister, that things get better for you. That's not what he had in mind when he used that particular word. And we know that because of Hebrews chapter 2. He meant do something for these people. Now, doing something may cost money or it may not cost money. If it does cost money, then James 1:27 authorizes the expenditure of funds. Those can be spent on orphans and widows. So we are, from the standpoint of the church treasury, authorized to help those people. We also have another verse when we think about aiding people, Galatians 6:10. So then, as we have opportunity, let us work that which is good toward all men, and especially toward them of the household of faith. Well, again, all people, assuming that they have a legitimate need, might be folks that we help, but Paul said especially be concerned about Christians, and that's what we did when we sent some money down to Florida. Certainly that money may have helped a number of people, but especially we wanted to aid God's people. Well, when you think about helping all people, Galatians 6:10, the poor come to mind, and we have a lot of poor folks in this area. We have a lot of poor people in the United States and a lot of poor people throughout the world. Jesus once said, you may remember from Matthew chapter 26, verse 11, that you will have the poor with you always. And he was exactly right. If other nations are any indication, America's poverty level is going to increase. I think that is a conclusion that we can sustain from a number of different methods of reasoning, but one additional way came to my attention just a few days ago. There was an article, I believe it was last Thursday, national article that talked about the country of Scandinavia. What we know, or how we define marriage in this country, that is one man and one woman, as far as Scandinavia is concerned, that's not a very popular idea. In fact, in this article that I read, it said in Scandinavia, and there was another country or two listed as well, but this was the most prominent one, they call a marriage between a husband and a wife, that one man, one woman relationship, and this is a direct quote, unusual. That's how far that they've gone. God's plan has, by and large, been dumped for alternatives. And this article, as I read it, was a fascinating piece, not that I obviously agreed with everything in it, but this article asserted that the people's quality of life had not been affected by scrapping God's plan for marriage. And then I thought, well, maybe there's a little bit more. It was a lengthy article, so as I continued to read, I found this, and here's another quote. The state provides maintenance allowances for children. Ah, there we go. And then I looked a little bit further and I saw this. Moreover, about two-thirds of the single mothers receive housing allowances from the government. Now, if destroying God's plan for marriage is so great, how come the government is forking out all kinds of paychecks to folks? They didn't bother to mention that at the lead of the article, but that is exactly what is happening. So my point is, if our government continues to toy with marriage in the way that other countries have, the level of people that are on our poverty rolls is certainly going to increase. And we have plenty of folks now calling for money, And it looks to me that if we have a nation that does this same kind of thing, then that problem is only going to get worse. But when those people do come, there are oftentimes legitimate needs, and the Bible instructs us to help those who need to be helped, and that certainly creates some challenges. We have, if you've ever done any work at all in benevolence, if you've been out one time, it's not hard to see quite quickly that you have people who have real needs, and there are people who are scammers, and sometimes we get taken. That's not anything that's pleasurable, that's not anything that's enjoyable, but we do try to separate the tricksters from the people who are legitimate, but sometimes doing that is just very, very difficult. There are other matters on which church funds may be expended. I get a paycheck from week to week, and I appreciate that. Just like if you get a paycheck, you probably appreciate that from week to week. And that is an authorized expenditure from church funds. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 9:14, this statement is not recorded in the Gospels, but the writer Paul knew that Jesus had said, preachers are people who deserve to be paid. Along with offering pay to preachers, we are entitled to take money from the church treasury and spend it on evangelistic methods and similar things. For example, we are entitled to use funds to build and maintain a building or something similar. You remember from Luke chapter 22, verses 11 and 12, it was time for the Passover meal shortly before Jesus was going to die. He told his disciples, I want you to go and I want you to find something. Jesus said, you go and you find a room. Now, on this occasion, a room was needed for just one night. Again, the Passover meal, there was no need to buy a room. But for us, we do not meet on just that single kind of occasion. We meet on a regular kind, on a regular basis. And for our meetings, we, of course, might have someone who would have a house or a large facility where we could meet from week to week. Or we might use funds to rent a place. We also have the option of doing what we have chosen to do here, and that is purchase a place. Somebody says, well, you know, it sounds like you're just making allegations or assertions. No, we can establish from the Bible that we are authorized to expend funds in this way. That's implied, I believe, in Luke chapter 22, verses 11 and 12. Place needs to be obtained, and Jesus said in this particular case, he's going to give it to you. But if that's not an option, if we do need to rent or buy, we are entitled to do those things. I'm turning to Acts chapter 28, verse 30. Because here is one of those little details in the Bible that you can see. In fact, this is right at the end of Acts, and quickly pass over. As you look at Paul's life, and Paul is the subject in Acts chapter 28, you are often introduced to his financial status, and that is, he was poor. He was so lacking in funds, 1 Corinthians 4:11 says that he was sometimes hungry. In that same verse, he says that he at times was without decent or proper clothing. Yet, when you come to Acts 28:30, here is the man who sometimes doesn't have the money for food. Here is the man who doesn't sometimes have the money for decent clothing. But this is said about him. And he, that's Paul, abode 2 whole years in where? Not in somebody's house, but in his own hired dwelling, and received all that went in unto him. Now here's what's so unusual about this passage. Paul was under house arrest. How does a man who is under house arrest worship? Well, obviously he's got to worship in his house. He can't go outside the residence, outside the dwelling where he is. If you're in jail today, then you have to worship in jail. And again, if you're under house arrest, you're going to worship at your home. Now here's a man who's under house arrest. Here is a man who, from other passages, we know he's poor. But Acts 28:30 tells us that he was renting his own place for 2 years. How did he get the money to do that? Well, he got it the same way that people in jail get it. It's sent, it's given by someone. So the next question is, who would have sent money to Paul for this period of 24 months so he could have this place to worship God and to instruct others in the basics of Christianity? Would it have been the Jews? Certainly not. The Jews were not going to be sending cash to him. They were opposed to the gospel. Paul was often hated by local townspeople. The only group of people that would be left are Christians. And in places like the Philippian letter, you find Paul saying that very thing, I receive funds from congregations like you. So we can use deductive reasoning to draw this conclusion. And that conclusion tells us that Paul received funds from Christians, and that, Acts 28, verse 30, gave him the means for a place to preach and serve God. If Paul were authorized to do that, and he was, Acts 28:30, then today we have that same right, we have that same entitlement. We might rent the place like Paul did, that certainly was the best option for him, or we might do as we have done here and buy some property and build a building. Now, sometimes when people get into this area to rent or buy a structure, they enter into areas of judgment, and sometimes the judgment is not always good. Congregation, for example, may not spend enough money to build the proper facilities. Case in point, here is a congregation that says we want to economize. So we're going to build this large barn-like structure, assuming that the state code would allow that, and we're not going to provide any chairs, we're not going to have heating, we're not going to have air conditioning, everybody just brings a flashlight. Well, if that were allowed by the state, that probably would not be a very wise way to go for a number of reasons. On the other end of the spectrum, somebody might say, we're going to build the most expensive building that we can build, and we're going to put in a $1 million baptistry. There have been some religious groups who have done that kind of thing as well. Well, both examples, of course, are illustrations of bad stewardship. Like most matters, the truth, the right way to go, is somewhere in the middle. As we strive for this middle road, when we begin to think about expending money on church property and buildings and so forth, we need to bear in mind as a congregation, not necessarily because of where we are now, but just a general principle, whether we are worshiping here or somewhere else, that when these kinds of times come, there can be disagreements among brethren. Even the disciples, when Christ was with them, demonstrated this in their life. I want to turn over to Mark chapter 14, read verses 3 through 5, and then make a comment or two and pick up with the information that's found in Mark 14:9. Again, Mark chapter 14, verses 3 through 5. And while he was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat down to meat, there came a woman having an alabaster cruse of ointment of pure nard, very costly. Mark says she broke the cruse and poured it over his, that's Christ's head. But there were some that had indignation among themselves, saying, to what purpose hath this waste of the ointment been made? For this ointment might have been sold for above 300 shillings and given to the poor, and they murmured against her. If you have ever been or you ever will be in a church building project, this is a good text to remember. Some may look at the plans for the building project and say, we need that. And then there may be some other people who say, we don't need that, it is a waste. Well, in cases of disagreements, we need to try to think through that matter as carefully as we can, because the conclusion that one group has may not be correct. Notice verse 9. Jesus, in responding to this, said people were thinking, well, short term, it's a waste. We could have taken this money, spent it on the poor. It would have been some help that we could have immediately been given to people, and now it's all been wasted. But Christ said, there's another perspective here. Verily I say unto you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached throughout the whole world, that also which this woman hath done shall be spoken of for a memorial. So Jesus said this was not a waste, this was not a bad thing, this is actually a good thing, and it has stood the test of time. So as we think about spending church funds, we certainly need to give careful examination and consideration to what's being put forward. Our idea may be right, or it may not. Our job as Christians is to, in part, count the cost. Luke 14, verses 28 and 29. Along with expending money on a building, we may use some of our funds with respect to items related to Christianity. We are to sing Ephesians chapter 5, verse 19. To facilitate that command, songbooks are typically bought, and we are entitled to do that. Christians are entitled to teach, and that's also something that takes money. Just a few days ago, we received a contact from our church website. A lady several hundred miles away has asked for a Bible correspondence course. Now, it's doubtful that I would have ever had contact with this lady had it not been for the internet. It's doubtful that anybody in this assembly would have ever had contact with this lady had it not been for the World Wide Web. But we are paying about $120 a year to maintain a website, and that is reaching people throughout the world. So again, you're not going to find a specific passage in the Bible which says take money from the church treasury and spend it on the internet. But you can find authorization to teach people, and that is one of the ways that we do that, even though there is a slight cost associated with it. Older preachers used to sum up church money and the spending thereof in three categories. They would say, and they were known for saying, it needs to be spent on edification, it needs to be spent on evangelism, and it needs to be spent on benevolence. And those are basically the three categories that we have. Worship is a little difficult to fit in there, but again, I guess under the general category of edification, that sort of qualifies. But we give, that's our obligation, and then elders in a local congregation put the monies in the right place. As we come together week after week and give, it's a good thing. It's helpful to us to keep in mind how our money is being spent. And again, those three categories that were just listed are the basic ways that funds are spent. By our contributions, we have a place to worship. We provide that same opportunity to others. We're teaching others, we're helping others, and pleasing God. Right now, we are in a season where the world puts a lot of attention on giving. As we go out and about, whether we're shopping or maybe driving to work, we'll see signs and hear on the radio and so forth that now is the season for giving. Well, the world looks at it that way, but when we look at the Church of the New Testament, the season for giving is 52 Sundays a year. And what we give, as you think back to Mark chapter 14, those monies that we spend are going to help accomplish some of the most important work that we will ever do in our lives. I'm not exactly sure, but sometime in the near future, you're going to see on that board a sign which says church budget. The elders have taken a look at what we want to do here, and they're going to have a figure posted there. And that figure, as you see that from week to week, is going to be related to the kinds of areas that we talked about tonight. And it's a goal that we want to meet week after week, so we can continue to do the work of God and do it as fully as we possibly can. But the starting place, of course, before we even talk about that and work with that, is to ensure that we are, number one, a Christian, and number two, that we are the kind of Christian who pleases God. We begin that walk by faith in Christ, a desire to live as the Bible describes, turning from the old way, confessing that Christ is going to be our Lord in every aspect of our life, and then we join with him through baptism, Romans 6, verses 1 through 4. And then once we've taken those steps, we're in a position to do some of the things that we've talked about tonight. Have you become a child of God, and are you living faithfully in his service? If the answer to either one of those questions is no tonight, we encourage you to write your relationship with him, and if we can help, we invite you to come as we stand and sing the selected song.